Today is Thursday. It's June 28th. It's 11:12 in the morning. This is John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio. I am also on weekdays on WGN from 1 to 3, and Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon, Scott Stantis.
I'm Scott Stantis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago. You knew I was reaching over to get something on my backpack.
What are you doing over there?
I was trying to grab a pen and paper because I write and draw when I do these things.
He's easily bored.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN and focused like a laser.
I'm Eric Zorn, the very tearful columnist for the Tribune.
I think I know why. By the way, guys, the only thing better than sitting around doing the Mincing Rascals is a trip to Paris that includes a riverboat cruise up the Seine to Normandy.
Great segue.
Kelly Cruises is going to do that, and they're a sponsor of the Mincing Rascals, July 30th, 2019, for 2 nights. We'll stay in a hotel by the Arc de Triomphe, and then after a couple of days there, we're going to get on board the AMA Waterways Amalira. We'll do a 7-night cruise along the scenic Seine. We'll visit the historic Normandy beaches on the year of the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Imagine that. Visit Monet's home and gardens in, I say Giverny, but I believe it's Giverny. Yeah, whatever. Josephine and Napoleon's chateau. We'll stop in Rouen. It's up the Seine and then back to Paris. It includes everything. Why are you laughing, Steve?
Because you say Giverny, but then you go Rouen?
Rouen.
But I know it's Rouen.
Sorry.
By the way, everything's included. Your tours, your excursions, bike tours, meals on board, beer, wine, soft drinks, lunch, dinner, cocktail parties. Paris, up the Seine to Normandy and back on the 75th anniversary of D-Day. KellyCruises.com or call 630-990-1111, 630-990-1111. Okay, a busy week. Mark Janis, a state employee, says that the Supreme Court ruling is a victory for Illinois workers.
I'm elated. I'm excited. This is just a fantastic victory for, public sector workers across the country in the 22 states that have been forced to pay these union fees.
The governor flew out there just to spike the thing in the end zone. The Supreme Court has said that you do not have to pay union dues to be in a union. You don't have to be in a union, and you don't have to pay the dues if you don't want to.
Well, the limiting factor, this is, we're talking about public sector unions now. This ruling did not affect private unions.
Yeah, it's just, I'm not a big fan of public unions. I think it makes the workers of the state workers adversarial towards the citizens of a state. I also am against coercion and forced membership in something. So I think, in my view, this is a fair decision.
It's not forced membership. You either take the job or you don't. That's what I kind of don't understand.
The job comes with the union
card. The job is a union job, and so if you don't want a union job, go work for subsistent wages somewhere else. I mean, I don't get that part.
Well, I don't get that you have to pay a bribe to have a job. I mean, it seems like the old, the muscle, the mob says that, well, you can have this job. You give us, a percentage of your take.
Do you think the union is good for the workers in the state of Illinois? Ask me? Yeah.
To an extent, is it good for the taxpayers?
I think that's almost a red herring for an employee. I think your concern should be what's best for you. Do you think that being a member of AFSCME gets those people better wages and better insurance benefits, better work conditions?
It does, and it has, and I think that in some instances, probably excessive.
So, Eric, then what happens to somebody who enjoys those benefits but doesn't have to pay for them?
He gets to ride for free. He gets the benefit of the better health coverage. He gets all the raises. He gets represented at grievance time. If he wants to have a grievance against management, the union still, by law, has to represent someone who does not belong to the union and doesn't pay any dues, which is why I talk about the freeloader problem, which is discussed at some length in both sides of the opinion yesterday. The majority thinks that it's not a problem, that the union would want to have these people in the union anyway. And the truth is that I have talked to the people that ask me, and they say they don't want what's called a members-only union because they feel like that would divide up the workplace. So they're going to go along with letting people like Mark Janis get their raises, get their representation at grievance time, get their health benefits.
Get their tires slashed, yeah.
Well, I don't know about that, but they certainly, you know, this is an issue with this particular decision that is kind of irreconcilable, and the reason that it applies to only the public sector unions is because there's a sense that the government is forcing someone to speak, quote unquote, speak by supporting a public sector union, and the support of a public sector union is a de facto political statement.
Steve, do you agree with that? It's a de facto political statement.
Well, I'm not a Supreme Court justice, you know, and so they ruled how they ruled. It seems a little tortured to me, but I mean, there's just a fundamental unfairness in all of this that comes out of this ruling. And like I was saying yesterday, I don't mean to sound like a 3-year-old, but it's not fair. I mean, that you would expect a union to represent and for people to benefit from and have them not contribute at all.
But public unions in Illinois are a revenue arm for the Democratic Party, aren't they?
Yeah, sure, they are. I think the Democrats nationwide, tell me, Eric, you would know this more than me, but 6% of their fundraising comes from public unions.
It sounds about right. The truth is that for the last 41 years or so, since the Abood decision that everyone talks about, 1977, and the Detroit Board of Education against Abood, the courts have allowed what are called fair share or agency fees, which means that you don't have to belong to a union. If you are a state employee, you don't have to belong to AFSCME, but you do have to, because you are enjoying the benefits of their contract, you have to pay what's called the agency fee or the fair share fee.
Which is much less than the regular dues.
It's about 78% of the regular.
Yeah, it's more than I thought it was, actually. I don't think they're not saving that much.
But then the other percentage that goes to the Democratic Party, that's part of the political process, part of the partisan political process, let's say, you don't have to pay. So Janis, as a fair share member, was not supporting ostensibly the donations that the union was making.
Don't you think that's a shell game?
Of course it is. Of course it is.
I only have to give here, but then the money that you would have given there, you get to give over there.
If it's a shell game, is it a reasonable shell game? I mean, is it a reasonable solution to this problem?
I think a better solution is you have two pools of individuals. Full disclosure here, when the union movement in the newsroom of the Chicago Tribune happened, I was one of the first people to sign the card.
Why?
Because I think it's important, because I think the people who run the company don't have the best interests of the employees in
mind. Do you know? So collective bargaining is a
right,
good thing.
But I wasn't forced to do this. I did it voluntarily. I have been in states that were right-to-work states and joined unions because it made sense. Let me finish the thought. Why couldn't you have two pools of workers in any given place? Why can't you have union representative and they get the benefits, they get
you tell me then. So the next Tribune employee who's hired to work in the newsroom, are they not going to be required to join the union?
You're a private company, but
they would be a closed shop.
You supported something that you're opposing for the state.
The difference here is that the state is the actor. That's what this whole argument was based on, which was that because the state is the employer, the state is and the state union contracts require you to join the union, the state is compelling you to speak through your dollars and support the activities of a public sector union, which the opinion found is an inherently political act. Now, it's kind of tortured, and it also makes me wonder, well, okay, so some states have, mandatory, a lot of things that states require, like, people to do. For instance, they require abstinence-only education, which I think has been proven to be a failure and a fraud. But they are supporting that. So my tax dollars are going to support that kind of speech. I object to that. I don't think there's a realistic way that you could say, well, okay, Eric, you get to write $10 off your taxes or $2
for that
50
part.
Cents off for that part. That's not how things work. And I think that's part of the argument that says that this was a workable solution.
All right, so here's what Kristen McQuarrie says about it. You knew Kristen would be good about this. Kristen said this. She couldn't join us today. So I wrote to her and I said, well, I know you've got a lot to say about this. You had a column this week. She said, I think one point that gets lost in all the panting about union busting is that the Janis ruling will not singularly break up unions. It will require union leadership to make a case that they are worth the investment. They will have to work harder to keep their members, like everyone in a free marketplace, newspapers, and then in bold letters, radio hosts, organizations, etc. Public employee unions have had a good run with government protecting their power through mandatory dues and fees. Now it's time to let the free market measure their value. And finally, she says, because I know Eric will bring it up. The idea of freeloaders might seem unfair, but as Alito noted in his opinion, that is not an issue for government to inject itself in, and it certainly does not overrule the constitutional free speech protection of those who don't want to support union efforts. Free speech beats whiny cries of unfairness. Eric?
Did she say Eric in there?
No, I threw the last Eric in.
It is a strange thing to put this as free speech, and I explain why this, you know, attenuated set of reasoning makes this a free speech issue.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it is the truth is that you can talk about, well, yes, and it's definitely true that unions are going to have to step up. They're going to have to, it's going to be a battle royal, because you're going to see the other side, the Illinois Policy Institute and those people, they're going to advertise heavily, as similar institutions have advertised heavily in other states. They want to break up these public sector unions. They want these public sector unions to die. They don't like them. Like, Scott doesn't like them either. Yeah. And our editorial board doesn't like them.
Wages in Illinois and the country are not rising fast for average workers.
Well,
and in states where we have unions, the rising tide lifts all the boats.
I think that's probably true. And you look at what happens in states where we give a worker a chance to have a free ride, say, hey, look, you can have all the benefits of being in union, but you get to save, you know, $600, $800, $900 a year. You know, they had guys in some states dressed up as Santa Claus going on, give yourself a present, drop out of the union. This is all about, I mean, we can talk all, you know, this gauzy rhetoric about free speech, and everyone cares about Mark Janus and his right to free speech.
Yeah, free speech.
That's really what this is about.
He says that.
I don't know what his motivation is, but I know that.
He says
everybody
it's not
who's
the money.
Backing this, they want to destroy public sector unions. Let's just be honest about it. Let's just say we don't like public sector unions, and some conservatives are. They think that it's wrong because you in effect have politicians. You have everybody sort of on the same side of the table, and the taxpayers who have no say in the negotiations are on the other side of the table. I understand that, but that's what this is about. This is about destroying public sector unions. It's not about this free speech.
I want to go back to Kristen's statement. The first sentence, I think, said now that unions will have to make their case or prove their worth.
Yep.
No, they don't. They won't have to do that. The people can quit and still have the full benefit of the union. There's no way or reason to persuade them.
I think the law in Illinois should change about that, don't you? Even though the unions have said they don't want that. But if I was a legislator, I would sure entertain somebody's petition to write legislation that would say you can't freeload. You could have a two-tier system. In fact, the state won't mandate that you represent people who aren't paying dues. That's easy.
My reading of the majority opinion was that those kind of laws would be unconstitutional. I think that's what Alito was saying in that opinion, was saying that would be that you wouldn't have equal protection if you treated one class of employees different from another.
Okay, one last thing about this. Do you guys think, though, this argument would be a little different? Maybe wouldn't even be happening if the public unions in Illinois were better, right? I mean, if they were more transparent, if they were more efficient, if they were less an arm of the Democratic Party?
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think, you know, when you talk about some of the benefits that they derive, especially, you know, the things like you can bump up someone's seniority for a day and get a higher pension.
Stuff. Right.
Games like that cost me real money.
Yeah.
That's what I think a lot of this frustration comes
from. Well, Kristen's column of the day had some good examples of times where unions overreach, where like some managers were chipping in during a really busy time at some office. I don't remember the details, but in a sense, like, it was a really busy time and some managers were helping out doing some things that unionized workers were doing, and they filed a grievance on them, and I think they ended up collecting or something. The grievance was resolved in their favor, that managers were doing work that unionized employees were doing. And that's, to me, that's just crazy. That's not common sense.
And that's everywhere, though. And everybody's got a story like that.
Well, no one denies that unions can overreach in protecting their turf.
Yep.
No one denies that.
I agree, Scott, that there are many abuses, and I don't want to defend. I'm uncomfortable defending unions, but I also know that one of the big problems we have right now in this country is the growing wage gap, the haves and the have-nots. And I think a healthier union presence would reduce it, or maybe the lack of it.
No, let me jump in.
Helping to create it.
I'm sorry, let me jump in and just agree with you on that. But I think private unions are where the growth has to be. And that's where the diminishment of private unions has been astounding over the last two decades. And that's where they need to build themselves back up. Because you're right, the middle class has been, it's hemorrhaging. We don't have, we practically don't have one anymore.
The typical union worker in 2014 paid $970 a week compared to $763 for non-union workers.
You mean a year?
$970 was a week versus $763 for non-union.
Dollars a week? But,
yeah, well, that's about, that's a little less than $50,000 a year or something like that.
A week? Wait a minute. $900
a week.
No, I think that's a year.
No, that can't be true. That's
you guys.
No, no, not paid in dues, but was
salary.
Paid at their job.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Okay, okay, okay.
And wow. More numbers in journalism coming up next.
All right, we got to move on to a different topic, but that is not the last we've heard of that. I wish the governor hadn't gone to Washington, D.C., despite this thing in the end zone, to do a victory dance.
I don't think he deserves nearly the credit that he's taking. He's like a rooster taking credit for the sun coming up.
Well, what's interesting is the Illinois Policy Institute standing there, and now they're standing next to each other, chummy-chummy, when they had such a falling out during the primary.
Besides, I don't think anybody really knows the consequences of this. Maybe this is really going to screw
up. Can I jump
people.
In on that?
Yeah.
The consequences in Wisconsin were that the union has, it's about a 60-40 split, 60 had stayed in the union, 40 left. Because, like you said, I think the numbers are $750 to $1,000 a year in union dues, and you're looking and saying, well, I can give myself $1,000 a year raise. This is nice.
Get the benefits of the union and not have to pay for it.
And, of course, the consequence of that means that the unions are going to be weaker, your raises are going to be smaller, your health care costs are going to go up. So your $1,000 is not going to be $1,000 at the end of the day, and your working conditions may suffer. And, you know, so, I mean, it's like, it's not a free lunch getting this money back. So I think, but, you know, in some ways, Kristen is right. The unions are going to have to make that case. They're going to make it strongly.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're going to be in a battle royal with the these conservative think tank groups that are going to want to try to, that are trying to bust these unions. They're going to be asking people to quit.
Is it wrong to ask Anthony Kennedy, the 81-year-old swing vote Supreme Court justice, to stay on for a couple more years?
Well,
I mean, I know he's not young, and I know he gets to have his own life, but you would think that just as unsettled as this country is right now, we need you particularly need that justice to stay on the Supreme Court.
I can't read his mind. I have to believe a couple of things. Mitch McConnell actually called off the summer recess, so I'm guessing they had some idea that this was in the works. I don't know if there's a health issue at play here. It could also be that Justice Kennedy looked at Justice Gorsuch, who was appointed by President Trump, and said, you know, this guy actually made a pretty good decision. That's the potential there. You know, they have the film. Have you ever seen the film? No, I can't remember what it's called, about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
RBG, isn't it?
Yeah. And
Notorious RBG.
Thank you. And I mean, so she's 85 years old. She clearly wants to hold on until there's a Democrat in that office. I don't, you know.
I'm doing a GoFundMe page for a treadmill and vitamin drinks for all of the Democrats.
Transfusions.
Supreme Court, whatever they need, whatever it takes.
Well, you know, I obviously can't read Kennedy's mind either, but he knows. I know that he reads the paper, follows the news. He knows what's going on. He knows that he is giving this Supreme Court pick to Donald Trump. He retired now. He could have waited a couple of more months, or he could have waited until after the November election.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
He would rather Donald Trump had the pick than Hillary Clinton. Or a Democrat, right?
I mean, but if he'd waited till after the November election, and there's a possibility, not a really high one, I guess, but there's a possibility that the Democrats will take the Senate, have control of the Senate, so that for Trump to get a nominee through, the nominee would have to be much more moderate, which would be sort of in his tradition. He's more of a swing justice than he is a moderate. If you look at his record, he has a lot of very conservative opinions, and then some, like, he was the guy who will go down in history, I think, is the guy who okayed gay marriage. He was the fifth vote on that.
Well, if he would just hold on for five more months, that might actually be a reason for some people to vote differently in the Senate races across the country. A third of them will be up, and you'd think that if your guy was close, you might just say, I do not want Trump to be able to get a nutty professor through.
Well, is Gorsuch a nutty professor? I don't think he is. I think he's a conservative justice who Democrats don't like, but he's qualified to be in the Supreme Court. And presidents get to pick people who are qualified to be on the Supreme Court, and senators are supposed to judge them by whether or not they are qualified.
Okay, the nutty professor.
Not by whether or not they like what they're going to rule.
The nutty professor is going to appoint a very conservative justice. But we would all be better off if it was a moderate
justice. Wouldn't all be. I mean, he won. I mean, you say we would all be. I think there are a lot of Republicans who say we wouldn't all be. And, you know, this goes back to the disgusting, abhorrent thing that Mitch McConnell did 2 years ago. It was wrong then, and it's, you know, and it would be wrong now for the Democrats to stop it or try to do it this time.
See, I hope the Democrats get a hold of the Senate, and I hope that if there's another vacancy, they say, we're going to wait as long as we can. We're going to wait 2 years because you stole that Supreme Court seat from us.
But don't you think that's still don't you think that's repeating a wrong?
Yeah, yes, thank you. I do think it's repeating a wrong, but you know, they basically rolled over and showed their belly in 2016. They didn't make an issue of this. They complained about it a little bit. They should have been raising hell in the streets over that. That was awful.
What's the matter?
And so are you going to give them another?
Because it's this whole idea that, well, that was wrong what they did 2 years ago. Absolutely. The worst thing. Yes, absolutely. And we should do it. Two. I mean, that's the dumbest argument I've ever heard in my life.
Well, look who's president. The guy who says, when you hit me, I hit back. And this is the politics of our nation right now. As I did a column the other day saying,
yes, you did.
It is time for Democrats to stop trying to be nice and act like what the people really want. It's all this nice debate and civilized debating society like we're in some civics textbook. We are not. This is bare-knuckle politics, and we've got a president who is threatening all of our constitutional norms, who has got autocratic, dictatorial impulses, and if we don't get angry about that and protest and get up on our hind legs, you know, we're just going to lose this country. We're going to have 7-8 conservative justices. They're already packing the lower courts. I mean, this is, you know, I said at the beginning, I'm the tearful columnist. This has been like one of the worst weeks for liberals, for Democrats that I can imagine. I mean, I can just imagine the end zone dancing going on at the Macquarie household, for instance, about how this is playing. I mean, there's almost no good news. There was that one woman who won a congressional primary.
The Latina in New York.
I mean, but there's been...
The socialist.
This is an awful, scary week now. I mean, and when you look at a now 6-3 conservative majority, it's going to be... Roe versus Wade is going to go away. Who knows what's going to happen with gay rights? All these things are going to be eroded.
Come on.
Well, what do you mean? Why would I think otherwise? Look, they have no interest in voting rights, right?
Are they going to revisit Dred Scott too?
They have no interest in voting rights, right? Look at the decisions in the past week. They, you know, just, I mean, look at what
they've taken internment camps off the table. We're safe there.
All these 5-4 decisions.
Eric, there was an anthropologist on TV this morning, and she said, you know, that human beings don't have claws and fangs. We don't survive because we are strong. We survive as a species. We've prospered because we're a cooperative species. It's the brain. It's the human interaction. That's what makes humans and Americans viable. And right, but if you're threatened, you get angry and then you do fight back. And it's possible to get in a sort of loop, a sort of fighting loop that really doesn't speak well of the species or of the way out for this country. We have to stop fighting fire with fire if we think what the other side is doing is wrong.
But Eric's right. If we do that, if the Democrats take the high road, you know, the Republicans are laughing all the way to the, you know, for
at
decades.
Some point. The low road is leading to victory. We also have opposable thumbs, which I just want to point out that is part of what makes
I'm now going to read this. If I understand it correctly, and watch me now, here's how a street gets named in Chicago, or a street's name gets changed in Chicago. And I may be wrong about this, but throughout the South, symbols of the Confederacy have been coming down. The flag, the statues of the generals, whatnot. That spread to other cities across the country. Symbols of racism were being erased. People who wanted some of those symbols to remain said, well, what about guys like Jefferson and Washington? They own slaves, so who gets to stay and who doesn't? And they said, are we going to erase all those street names? And in Chicago, in fact, we have a street named after Italo Balbo. He flew from Rome to Chicago in 1933 in honor of our Century of Progress Expo. But he was also a big player in fascist Mussolini's Air Force. So now there's a movement to change the name of that street, Balbo, to Ida B. Wells, the black activist journalist. But the Italians don't want to lose the name of that street. So the compromise will be to keep Balbo Balbo and then rename the only other street name less popular than a racist or a fascist. That would be part of Congress. So Congress will now be Wells. But the problem with that is we already have a Wells in Chicago. So we'll have an Ida B. Wells. And that's how part of Congress gets changed.
And there will be an intersection of Wells and Wells.
Well, what's the matter with all of that, Eric?
Well, my idea was to rename Wells Street, which is named for William Wells, who was in the Battle of Fort Dearborn, and who already has a county named after him in Indiana, name that street for Ida B. Wells, so that you could gradually change your station area.
This was never about Wells. It was always about Balbo. Well, so Balbo gets to stay Balbo, and now part of Congress changes.
Well, I think Well, I think that Balbo should be changed to some other prominent Italian-American, Enrico Fermi, or Cardinal Bernardine, one of those people like that?
Fermi would be swell.
Why not? But, you know, what this managed to do, this solution they came up with this week in City Council, was to sort of split the difference and to separate these issues.
And avoid the issue entirely.
Well, and you know, the Italian-Americans make 2 points. One, which I don't agree with, which is that Balbo should be celebrated for his, we should just overlook his little role in aiding Mussolini and talk about all his wonderful achievements as an aviator. I disagree with that, but you know, they also make the point that there are a lot of streets, numbered streets, streets that have that are, you know, like State Street,
boring,
for instance,
streets
that just aren't named for anyone, that could be open to be renamed. You wouldn't have to mess with that.
I don't know how we make this transition from talking about the Supreme Court. I mean, I'm still kind of sick over that and what's happening. So how about Merrick Garland? Can we name a street after Merrick Garland?
He's still ticked about that, and he always will be, and he always will be.
We all should be.
Hey, next year can be the Biden rule.
Can you?
Which never existed.
Okay, stand by.
Sorry.
2 weeks ago, Scott wasn't able to join us, but it was the same week that a columnist, a cartoonist, a colleague and friend of yours at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette lost his job. No, quit his job, right, Scott?
No, he was fired.
He was fired? He kept drawing cartoons that were critical of President Trump. The newspaper has a new editor who is more in favor of the president. They finally fired him for instance, on Memorial Day, weeping over the state of the country and things like that. What do you make of all of that?
Oh, it's repulsive. The Block family has owned the Blade newspapers, which is all of two newspapers, to the Toledo Blade and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, decided that he loved Donald Trump. He had his picture taken with him. And so Rob, who has been a dyed-in-the-wool liberal Democrat. Rob Rogers,
Rob
Rogers. And Rob has been that way forever. He's worked at the paper for over 25 years. And the Block family brought in a director of opinion, which, again, is weird because it's two newspapers. But, okay, it's not my money, so they can do what they want. But he was brought in ostensibly to fire Rob, or at least bring him into. They made him an offer saying, okay, here's the thing. We can make you a freelancer. You have to send us three roughs every morning, and we have the opportunity that when you send in your cartoon, we can edit it. So he could send in an anti-Trump cartoon.
Do you have an editor like that?
No, I haven't.
Do you, as a journalist, as a writer, Eric, do you have somebody who...
Oh, we all have editors, and we all need editors, and sometimes they can catch us. Well, we need... You know, Scott, I make typos. You make typos.
Content.
Content. I will have conversations once in a while but not too often. But you always need another set of eyes on something to make sure that you're not like misrepresenting.
Yeah, that's not
something.
What this was.
No, but okay, but content. I think once you when you hire, you know, I mean, it's I hate to make sort of a blanket statement like, no, you should never edit somebody's cartoon, because every once in a while a column or a cartoon will inadvertently go too far. Will say something it doesn't mean to say. Will have an image that is needlessly offensive. And certainly there are stories about that in cartooning history. It's good to have another set of eyes, but it's not good to have someone go like, this is making fun of Donald Trump. We don't want that. That I mean that's a totally different.
What question. Is but if it's his paper. And it's not reflecting the view, the editorial stance that he wants
his
paper
to reflect.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What's the editorial position of that newspaper?
Well, now it's very pro-Trump.
Okay, but that would be like then if Krista McQuarrie, who writes editorials for the Tribune, started turning in editorials that were at odds with the stated position
of
the paper.
Difference is that Kristen does hand in columns that differ from our opinion, and I hand in cartoons that differ from our opinion, and the difference is that our names are on them. They're not the opinion. They're not the institutional.
Those are columns, though, right?
Well, but Scott's cartoon is very similar to a column.
More so than an editorial.
Yeah, definitely. Much more so. The editorials are separate. The editorials is the newspaper itself speaking, ostensibly. And the cartoons and the columns and the op-eds are individual voices speaking.
So
there's an important distinction. So if a paper wants to just have one point of view expressed in all its columns, its op-eds, I think it's a terrible business decision because I think that's not what people want. I think people want to see a variety of views in their daily newspaper. But if that's what they want, I guess they certainly have that right. I think as Steve.
Well, I can see in Pittsburgh though how people would not like every day to see another, you know, snarky elitist cartoon picking on our president who's working to save coal and steel, and there in Pennsylvania they have to put up with that crap every day. I could see them not liking that. I mean. From a business standpoint.
I suppose. I don't know that there was predicated on that as much as it was the personal predilections of the publisher owner. And the way this played out was horrible too. They could have done it any million other ways to do it. They stopped running Rob's cartoons. He'd do the cartoons, he'd hand them in, and they just refused. They just didn't run them. And so it was 19 of them when it finally came to the critical mass. They could have laid them off and just, you know.
Right.
I mean, we work in a business where layoffs are not uncommon. They could have just said, hey, listen, we want to go in a different direction. There's a million other ways they could have handled this, and they just handled it about as abominably as they possibly could have.
Any last topics you guys want to throw at me here before we go to our recommendations for the week?
McCann for governor.
Yeah,
that's fascinating to me. And as a Republican, I
state lawmaker who's going to challenge
downstate pro union Republican
who gave a statement against the Janus decisions.
Is that right?
Yes, he did.
But for those of us who are looking for someone, I mean, obviously Rauner has been a train wreck. He has been ineffectual at best. Can't possibly vote for Pritzker because he's a tax and spender and has shown no interest in cutting either of those. So who do you look for? McCann could be a thing, and I think it will could tip the balance. Could be enough votes away from Rauner to tip it towards Pritzker.
I officially announced yesterday I'm going to vote for governor for whoever has the fewest toilets.
That would be McCann. It would have to be McCann.
It would be McCann now because JB's got so many.
Which is ironic given his last name.
And Rauner has nine homes.
Rauner has nine homes, and I'm doing
each one.
I'm figuring that's 27 minimum toilets. So, you know, if you want somebody who's a little more connected to the people, you probably want this.
Well, for the guy with the fewest cans, and that would be McCann.
That would be.
Or the guy who's least flush.
What's your recommendation, Steve Bertrand?
I've been watching. I'm not altogether in favor of it right now, but I just started watching this series called Bosch, which is on Amazon, and it's based on the Michael Connelly novels. Euonymous Bosch, or Euonymous Bosch, Harry Bosch, is a L.A. detective, and the novels were wildly successful. I would interview Connelly back in the early aughts when he would come through, and it's a pretty good L.A. cop drama. It's a little too dramatic, like the chief sometimes speaks a little too affectedly, like he thinks the chief should, so I don't love that, but overall, I think I found the new series to stay with for a while. Bosch.
How about you, Mr. Zorn?
I'm recommending cottage cheese. I'm serious. There's an amazingly long feature in the New York Times the other day about the revival of cottage cheese, which was pushed to the side by yogurt long ago, and now it's supposedly making a comeback. And we have a strong difference of opinion in my family about it. My wife and I really like it. Our kids will not touch it. They think it's really gross.
Yeah.
Kevin Pang, who we all know, I think, was quoted in the New York Times story as being just completely disgusted by cottage cheese and saying, he says, I eat anything. I've eaten horse, and I won't touch cottage cheese. But I think cottage cheese is great. It's light and flavorful. It goes with fruit. It's great on its own. It goes with noodles. It's a fabulous thing. So
Cottage cheese.
Okay. I'm recommending the second season of Brockmire on IFC. It started off very rocky. The first season I thought was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And the second season started off as very formulaic, very state. And my wife, Jenny, and I watched it, and we thought, oh, boy. You know, this is one of those one-season shows. But about midway, episode three or four, it starts to get its legs under it again. And by the end of the season, it is a terrific, tremendous show. I still think it's one of the most underrated shows on TV.
The cop drama?
No. This is Brockmire is Azaria, who does many of the voices in the Simpsons. And I did not know he was this good an actor. He plays a sportscaster who always talks like this
minor league team, right?
Right. And he gets an opportunity to go to the majors and totally blows that. And then he's a reprobate, but he's a lovable reprobate.
I'm glad you brought that up because when that first came out, it sounded so good and I never caught on with that. Second season catches
second
up.
Second season, yeah. Skip the, well, you got to watch it. Just
I'll watch it.
Watch the story arc.
What network is that on? Do you know by any chance?
You said IFC. You can get the app and watch it whenever you want to.
Okay, my recommendation is Bad Blood. It is the story of Elizabeth Holmes, the founder of Theranos, or co-founder. Theranos, remember, is that company that's gone bankrupt now.
Blood test. Right?
She's under federal fraud investigation, right?
Indictment. She's been indicted, I think, right?
Absolutely.
Facing 20 years?
You prick your thumb and they get a drop of blood. It goes into a machine that would be at your house or at a Walgreens, say, and suddenly the pitch was it'll run 196 diagnostic tests, something like that. And it'll tell you anything and everything you ever wanted to know. If you're on some drug regimen, you need to know if you're getting too much of the drug, too little of the drug, or maybe you just want to know what your stuff is. A drop of the blood, it was going to be a billion-zillion-dollar game changer. It tells the story about how that thing went bad and how she's now been indicted and will probably go to jail. I don't know how she
does. Well, it's fraud, right? I mean, it's just falls-out fraud.
It was fraud from the get-go. And yet, it's so fascinating to see how everything that should have caught up with her and them didn't. Companies kept throwing, rich guys kept throwing millions of dollars.
Does it explain how her conscience and how people who knew what this was, how they kept going, this was going to kill people, literally.
Yeah, right, because people would maybe get false results or results that weren't, would say you're okay when you're not. Yeah. I guess that's a false result. Yeah, in fact, some people were quitting left and right thinking this is a dangerous proposition we're in, but they all had to sign non-disclosure and non-disparagement agreements, and they were all terrified that they'd get sued or in trouble. So people kept getting fired and quitting. Walgreens does not come off very well in this story. They were enamored of the idea, even though they had red flags left and right. For instance, just a quick anecdote. And Safeway fell into the same trap. They would say, okay, here's this new thing. And they bring out a box that looks like a toaster meets an iPod. And they would test their blood, put in a little cartridge, and it would go in. And they would say, okay, what's the results? And they said, well, I'll tell you what. This is at the meeting with, say, the Walgreens hoo-has. And they say, we'll get the results back to you. And they never did. And the one guy on the Walgreens team was like, I think we need to see the results. And they were so enamored of her because she was attractive, had a deep voice, had piercing eyes, was magnetic. And everybody loved her. And they loved the idea, and they were afraid that they couldn't miss, right? What if you're Walgreens and Costco says, okay, then fine, we'll take the damn thing. So even though they had every reason to doubt it, everybody was afraid they were going to miss this medical revolution. And millions of dollars were thrown at this person who was 22 years old. And now she's probably going to go to jail.
The idea makes some sense, right? It's kind of sort of intuitively makes sense. Like, oh, well, if you have a little bit of blood and you have a good enough machine, you can tell a lot from that.
And I'm a bit of a hypochondriac. So, yeah, if it was like $5 and you take the drop, every time I'd walk by, I'd go, well, let's see how I'm doing.
Well, that's why that was the problem, too. She was afraid of needles. She said, so I don't want you to draw a lot of blood. But a prick, one drop, fine. They said, that's not enough blood. We need more blood. So the problem began, how do you thin that into a larger quantity of blood, run a bunch of tests on it, and then get results. And it was never going to work that way. It's a fascinating story. It's called Bad Blood. Scott, good to see you.
Great to be seen.
Eric Zorn, Christian McQuarrie, thank you for writing in. And Steve Bertrand, too. Ben Cortez engineered the Mincing Rascals. Thank you, Ben. We're produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.